Half an hour after Prime Minister Tepler's departure, politicians and military officers began entering the room beneath Tepler's viewing chamber. They traveled in groups, one important dignitary backed by 3 to 5 members of support staff, with the dignitary and one aide seating themselves at the large triangular table dominating the room. The others exiled to secondary tables or far corners, there to remain until summoned. As these people spoke in their small groups, Han and Leia could occasionally make out their words whenever they were projected across the table or the room. Soon enough, Han realized that they were being augmented by a set of speakers in the wall beneath the long viewport. Eventually, the highest-ranking officer so far, Admiral Vera Karathis, Chief of Staff for the Ministry of War and Operational Leader of the Corellian Military, entered with her retinue. All the other officers straightened, looking busier and more efficient, and the big chamber's upper lights came on in full strength. Standing at one truncated point at the triangular table, Karathis pointedly drew a chrono out of a jacket pocket and consulted it. As she did so, several of the other officers glanced in the direction of Tepler's box, beneath it actually, and a trifle to the left, and exchanged eye contact and words with one another, reacting to some new arrival and indicating that at last things might proceed. From the direction they had been looking, Wedge Antilles, again in Corellian uniform, walked into the room, without retinue. Admiral Karathis gave Wedge a wan smile.
Cutting it rather close, aren't you, Antilles?
Wedge nodded and moved up to the table beside Karathis.
Admiral, if I had a credit for every time someone told me that... Yes, you could probably buy our way out of this situation.
Karathis looked up, in a direction disconcertingly close to where Han and Leia sat, but her eyes seemed to be focused on a point to their left, beyond the wall that separated them from the next room.
Are we all ready? Yes? Then let's begin. Please, sit.
She did as she suggested, and there was a momentary delay as some officers fled the main table and others trotted up to it, seating themselves.
All right,
Karathis said.
We find ourselves in the unenviable, unacceptable, but unavoidable position of having to wage a battle against enemy forces occupying the center of one of our own cities. We cannot do this without a gruesome toll in the lives of our own people, which could very well swing public opinion against us, which would be increasingly harmful to our defense of the Corellian system. Nor can we just ignore the enemy beachhead, as leaving it intact will allow them to reinforce it, expand it, and begin bringing more and more potent offenses against our in-system positions. Their command post in Relidir on Trollis has to be obliterated, and so Operation Noble Savage has been designed to obliterate it, and to turn what would be public opinion disaster into an asset.
Han and Leia shiver. He gave her a questioning look. She didn't say anything about minimizing expected civilian deaths, she said. Han leaned forward to give Karathis a closer look.
Maybe she's getting to that.
Maybe. Below, Karathis gestured to someone out in the shadows along the big room's walls. A hologram sprang into existence above the center of the table, a view of the center of the city of Relidir, inverted so that those at the table looking up were actually looking down into the monolithic block of skyscrapers as if from a great height. The disc-shaped hologram began a slow rotation, and then a large region at the center of it, a massive circular white building with 8 narrowing points around its rim, giving it the appearance of a royal crown, began blinking red, white, red, white. The building was easy to make out among all the skyscrapers, as it was surrounded by a broad belt of green, occasionally decorated with narrow gray lines, a large city park with foot trails tracing through it. Karathis continued.
This is their command post. They've occupied the Naval Center for the Performing Arts. This was a very good choice, speaking from a military point of view. It's commodious, has an extensive underground storage area not accessible through any of the city's normal underground infrastructure, and commands a good view of the surrounding airspace. It's also sound strategically, because the center is right in the heart of one of the most densely occupied portions of central Relidir. Any standard action waged there will result in thousands of civilian casualties. One concussion missile missing its target could bring down an entire superhabitat building. And inevitably, there will be missiles missing their targets. Many of them. Our grim task has been to turn that terrible but inevitable consequence of war to our advantage. However, despite their good choices, the GA has made some poor ones too, situating several starfighter squadrons and some planet-landable fighting vessels around their command post as a show of strength gives us more things to destroy, explosively, catastrophically, and most important, recordably, when we do hit that site.
This is bad, 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 Han said. He couldn't keep an edge of anger out of his voice. The wire grid shield indicators began blinking more erratically.
In the first part of our operation, teams of commandos will be infiltrated into Relidir. They will attempt to reach the shield generators and destroy them with high explosives. Success on their part is to be considered a bonus to our plan, but the plan does not rely on it.
On the upside-down view of Relidir, half a dozen green dots appeared at various points along the view's rim and sped toward the enemy command post, each followed by a stream of red dots.
In the second part of the operation, Corellian YT-5100 Shriek-class bombers will assault the shielded region from all sides, closely pursued by a Galactic Alliance starfighters and warships. They will bombard the shields, if any survive, and then continue their bombardment of the command post until it is destroyed. The Shriek-class bombers have been chosen because they are distinctly, uniquely, unmistakably Corellian. Designed by the Corellian Engineering Corporation, they have not entered full production yet. Only 10 late-model prototypes and a few earlier prototypes are in existence. The pursuing spacecraft, though bearing the colors and insignia of vehicles and vessels of the Galactic Alliance fleet, will actually be units of the Corellian Defense Force. Instead of shooting down the Shrieks, other than hitting them with a few reduced-strength laser blasts for cosmetic effect, their mission will be to reinforce the firepower of those bombers, and to reassign blame for civilian deaths to the Galactic Alliance.
Silence fell in the wake of the Admiral's words. Leia put her face into her hands, not an expression of grief, but a way to keep her composure. Han took a long, deep breath. It had gotten worse. Wedge turned a brilliant, bitter smile on the Admiral.
It would seem that the plan would actually benefit if we maximize civilian casualties.
Leia lifted her head, her eyes wide. Admiral Carathis' face relaxed into a non-expression, as though she'd just been hit by a blaster set to stun.
General Antilles, that might be the most callous thing I've ever heard you say.
Wedge looked scornful and made a dismissive gesture.
Admiral, let's call a skifter a skifter. Operation Noble Savage is, as you yourself said, designed to take what is inevitably going to be a public relations nightmare, the deaths of thousands of civilians from friendly fire, and turn it to the advantage of the Corellian independence cause. It will take outrage that would have been directed against us and turn it against our opponents. That outrage will stiffen Corellian resistance against the GA, allowing us to hit harder, more ferociously. By an inevitable progression of logic, the more horrible the offense we can blame on the GA forces, the greater that outrage, correct?
Carathis blinked.
General, I'm within seconds of ordering you to shut up and leave this council. That would be a mistake,
Wedge said.
If you did that, you'd prevent me from showing you how to achieve your military objectives without wantonly killing fellow Corellians.
Carathis paused. A square of light fell across the table as another of the observation rooms was illuminated from within. Its occupant had obviously turned on its interior light so as to be seen from below. Han and Leia looked around the bank of observation booths, but none they could see was now illuminated, meaning that the one they were looking for had to be close to theirs. Then a voice, electronically amplified, boomed from the room just to their left.
General, am I to understand that the operation I helped design, that I approved and am ready to set into motion, is wanton?
Leia winced, and Han felt like drawing his blaster. That cutting voice was distinctive, instantly recognizable. It was Thrakken Sal Solo. Wedge turned to face Sal Solo's viewport, meaning he was staring almost directly up into Han and Leia's as well.
No, sir. As I'm sure your protocol droid is now telling you, my use of the word wanton referred to the unnecessary deaths of so many of our kinfolk and fellow citizens. And there's the additional factor that while this group might be able to maintain for years the terrible secret that we were responsible for those deaths, we wouldn't be able to keep it forever. Secrets like hydraulic fluids have a nasty habit of seeping out into the open, just when it's worse for everybody.
Sal Solo's voice boomed again.
Was that a threat, Antilles?
Wedge made a dismissive gesture Han knew would have to outrage Sal Solo.
No, it was a realistic appraisal, and my realistic appraisal of Operation Noble Savage suggests to me that it would be effective and that it would probably succeed, but that it would not be efficient. To be efficient, it would have to accomplish our goals with minimal loss of civilian life, and with a chance to reduce, instead of increase, our chance to enter a full-scale shooting war.
And can you do all that, General, and put a shine on your reputation while you're at it?
I can, and put a shine on your reputation.
Let's hear it,
Sal Solo said.
If I like what I hear, you might not find yourself begging on a street corner come morning.
Wedge turned his back on the man's booth. From a breast pocket, he removed a data pad. Looking around, he apparently spotted the room's hologram input sensor. He pointed the data pad at it, and abruptly the hologram image overhead changed. Once again, it was the center of Relidir, but a less realistic plotting of it. The skyscrapers were all simple gray rectangles, their windows, balconies, and decorations not represented. A moment after the hologram resolved into crisp detail, dome-like translucences in pink appeared to show the two sets of shields maintained by the Galactic Alliance occupiers.
Same problem, different solution,
Wedge said. On the hologram, two flights of green blips, six blips per flight, two half squadrons, appeared at the edges of the displayed region, the first from one angle, and the second from an angle 90 degrees to that of the first. The first flight overflew the shield-protected region. A moment later, the second flight followed suit. Now red dots appeared on the display, in numbers rapidly swelling from 20 to 100, and formed up to follow the green dots. Both the pursued and the pursuers exited the scene within moments. Wedge continued.
Stage 1 is a diversionary bombing run on the shields. Standard operational procedure to overload shields and bring them down. Given that the GA occupiers have not only installed military power generators at the site, but also commandeered city power generators and can feed them straight into their shields, the shields possess a lot of power. This run will fail, and the bombers will make a quick bounce up to orbit, drawing off a certain amount of pursuit.
Wedge tapped another button on his data pad. Just barely within the outer perimeter of the shields, a massive gray building began to blink in color, alternating between green and yellow.
This is the Turkuri Housing Complex, currently under construction, being built on the site of an old complex that had to be deconstructed for safety reasons. The new complex will be somewhat more upscale than many of the surrounding housing units, providing modern amenities and a broad underground hangar area for private skimmers, shuttles, and the like.
Sal Solo's voice was richly mocking.
You almost make me want to live there.
At the moment, sir, it's not a very good investment. Stage 2 of this operation involves taking a couple of those Shriek-class bombers and flying them clean through the Turkuri housing complex, then continuing on to the Arts Center and initiating its destruction.
The angle of the schematic changed, dropping the point of view until it was oriented mere meters over a broad thoroughfare. At the far end of the thoroughfare was the blinking green and yellow building.
I mentioned the housing complex's broad underground hangar.
The hologram's point of view went into motion, traveling toward the blinking building at a high rate of speed.
Here you can see a simulation of the Shriek bombers' approach toward the housing complex. When they get to the distance of a few blocks, they release some of their ordnance.
Blue dotted lines leapt forward toward the blinking building, but dropped at the last moment to strike the thoroughfare just ahead of it.
And blow a broad hole in the avenue, straight down into the hangar area. They fly through the hangar, blowing out an exit ahead of them, and emerge through that hole on the far side, then continue on to their target. As they approach their target, they release their payload of targeter droids, rather crude droids used by our armed forces to teach sharpshooting and ballistics. Those droids use laser rangefinders and other sensors to paint their target, defining not just the command center, but a precise point on its shielding.
And then?
finally Sal Solo sounded interested rather than mocking.
And then the hundreds of missiles fired in the wake of the two shrieks, following the telemetry sent by those targeter droids, come pouring out of the hangar bay, hit that point on the shields, overload them until they fail, and continue on to hit the command post, plus the vehicles and vessels on the ground, surgically eradicating them. Let me make sure I understand,
Sal Solo said.
Your two shriek bombers, they'll be sustaining fire from any GA defenses not drawn off by our diversion.
Correct,
Wedge said.
That means gunships, starfighters, anti-spacecraft gun emplacements, and who knows what else.
Correct.
How do they do this?
Well,
Wedge said.
First, the performance characteristics of the shrieks are known to the GA government. But since the bombers aren't in production yet, that information hasn't been widely distributed. It's not likely to be in the databases of the GA forces around Trallis. This means the defenders won't know exactly what to expect from these machines. Second, the fact that the assault force seems inadequate to the task means the forces arrayed against the shrieks will probably not be overwhelming. And third, I plan to choose, assuming I'm selected to implement this plan, otherwise I'll just recommend, pilots who are especially well-suited to this sort of mission. I don't mean the pilots who've been testing the shrieks, good men and women though they are. I mean canny old veterans who have decades of experience with YT-series spacecraft. Pilots familiar with terrain-following assaults and other seemingly suicidal flying techniques.
Han leaned farther forward, almost pressing his forehead against the transperisteel, his attention fixed on Wedge. He heard Leia whisper,
"Oh no."
Thrakken, sounding cheerful, boomed,
"Admiral Carathis, I think this plan deserves close scrutiny."
Quat System, Toyaz Station.
Jason sat in the rolling chair with his feet up on the desk before him. He knew that the image he was holocasting would show his boot soles up close, the rest of his seated body at a slightly greater distance, and then Ben solemnly standing behind his chair. Jason held the grouping of tassels up before him and studied it. All of it?
I don't know. I can only speak for the one at the very bottom. It's like writing,
the Twi'lek said.
A pattern of knots, so individualized, so specific that they can carry thoughts the way writing does. I actually had to take the highest detail holocam scan you sent me of it and run it through a sculpture interpreter, generating a three-dimensional replica in a flexible material before I could interpret it. It must be held, manipulated by touch in order for its meaning to become clear.
And its meaning is what?
As close as I can translate it into basic, it means he will strengthen himself through pain.
Jason gave the Twi'lek a close look.
You look startled, Master Solo.
Jason shook his head. I'm not a master, just a Jedi Knight for Ollie. I apologize if I led you to believe that you're speaking with a social equal.
I do not think in such segregated terms, Jedi Solo.
As for my startlement, that phrase has echoes of an old Jedi saying, there is no pain where strength lies. Could it actually be translated that way? For Ollie shook his head, the gesture deliberate and artificial.
No. It is closest to, he will strengthen himself through pain.
And you can't read any of the others?
No, they are not Twi'lek.
Jason considered. So, these other tassels, could they still be the same sort of item? A form of writing?
Yes, or I think several. They are distinct in the ways they were made, each fabricated through a different technique. I suspect it means that, if they all convey messages, each does so through a different method of communication, perhaps from a different world or culture altogether.
Jason gave him a smile. I know this is going to sound lazy.
But is there a central source of knowledge that might be able to decode all of them?
You're very good at mind reading, Farali. Are you force sensitive?
No, I am merely well acquainted with academic laziness.
The Twi'lek considered.
I would recommend the World of Lord. It is a repository of academic knowledge, and its people, like my own, have developed a greater facility with non-verbal communication than most. Perhaps it wouldn't prove the odds that they have concentrated knowledge in this field. But you must take the item there.
Jason nodded. Just what I wanted to know. Thank you, and goodbye.
Farewell.
Jason leaned forward to punch the disconnect button, and the hologram of the Twi'lek faded from view. Jason relaxed back into his chair and sat for long moments, studying the bottom tassel.
So we're going to Lord? Ben asked.
We're going to Lord. Go pack.
Coronet Corellia.
The war conference room was almost empty. Wedge Antilles shook hands with Admiral Carathis and her aides, then watched them depart the chamber. He began fiddling with his data pad.
We do need to wait for the YVH droids to come back for us, Leia said.
I know that, Han protested. I wasn't planning on popping out into the corridor while Thrakken's security team waits out there.
Well, you looked impatient.
Han tried to force himself to look less impatient.
Don't volunteer, Leia said.
Huh? For what?
For Wedge's plan.
I have to, Leia.
That mission was made for me.
General Antilles.
It was Thrakken's voice again, still booming from the next observation room. Below, Wedge glanced up again.
Sir, I have a favor to ask of you, as Minister of War. Something that's distinctly in your patriotic duty to do. Something you really should have done by now.
Thrakken's tone was pleasant, not at all urgent. Wedge returned his attention to his datapad.
Let's hear it. You have a daughter serving with the Galactic Alliance Armed Forces under the name of Lysa Dunter. She's assigned to the force occupying Trallis.
Wedge closed his datapad and tucked it into a pocket, then casually turned his chair to face up at Thrakken.
Yes, she's in the GA Armed Forces, as a lot of Corellians are, though I'm not sure where she is right now.
I'm going to send her a message. I'd appreciate it if you'd include a note asking her to cooperate with what I suggest.
And what are you going to suggest?
That's not really your concern.
Wedge didn't even attempt a pretense at unconcern or amusement.
Of course it is. I'm supposed to endorse whatever you suggest to her, regardless of what it is?
Yes. It's your duty. I have to insist. Go ahead.
Now Thrakken's voice sounded confused.
What?
Go ahead. Insist. I'm interested in hearing this.
All right. General Antilles, acting as Chief of State and Minister of War for Corellia, I hereby order you to communicate with your daughter Sael and do your genuine best to persuade her to follow whatever course of action I recommend to her. Is that clear enough?
Absolutely.
And?
Go to hell. Leave my family out of things, Sal Solo.
I'm going to communicate with your daughter. I'll convince her to do what I say.
Go ahead.
Wedge shrugged.
You're not worried that I'll succeed?
You might succeed, but I won't be party to it.
There was no reply. A few seconds later, the light from Thrakken's chamber, still spilling in a distorted rectangle across the main table below, switched off. Wedge walked toward the exit and disappeared out of sight below Thrakken's chamber.
Wedge just got himself killed, Leia said.
Han nodded. He's too smart not to know that. It won't be soon, though. Thrakken needs Wedge, for now.
Battle carrier Dodana, orbiting Trallis.
Ensign Lysa Dunton and her Quarren wingmen rose toward the field, holding the atmosphere within Dodana's main belly hangar. With casual ease, they reduced velocity as they neared the glowing opening, popped up through the field to allow the air resistance to slow them down another crucial few kilometers per hour, and floated on repulsor lifts to their designated landing zone. Moments later, they raised their cockpits. Crew members rushing forward hung ladders in place, allowing them to exit their vehicles. Mechanics arrived, plugging in diagnostic units, beginning refueling.
Ensign Dutton!
The chief mechanic, a lean man with dark eyes, approached her with his diagnostic datapad in hand.
Can I speak to you for a moment?
Of course.
She shook her hair out. You usually work with the X-Wing units, don't you?
Yes, Ensign, but everybody's being shifted around across train while we have some downtime. I put in a request to work on the E-5s today.
Sile eyed his datapad. Is there a problem with my interceptor?
Not exactly.
He moved close and lowered his voice so the rest of the crew couldn't make out his words.
Actually, I just wanted to bring you some greetings from home.
She gave him a sharp look.
Greetings from Raltir?
Greetings, he said, from Corellia. Perhaps we should talk somewhere private?
An hour later, Vibrosword Leader, a tall human with graying hair and features suggesting that he was an actor hired to play a squadron leader, leaned over the interrogation table toward Sile and asked,
So you shot him?
Beside him sat a human woman, dark-skinned, with big eyes that looked bright and uncritical enough to belong to someone much younger. Sile had never seen her before. Sile nodded.
I still don't understand,
the woman said.
Why did you shoot him?
He lunged for my blaster pistol, Sile said.
Why did you have a blaster pistol? Leader asked.
So I could take him into custody.
No, the woman said.
You took it out to take him into custody. Why did you have it in the first place?
I always do, Sile explained. When I got old enough to begin dating, my father insisted that I carry one. That was a small lie. Her father had insisted that she carry two.
And you drew on him because he was trying to suborn you?
The woman continued. Sile nodded.
Do a few things for us, he said, meaning the Corellians.
The woman looked skeptical.
Ensign Dutton, you're a very low-ranking officer and a carrier full of people who could do the GA more harm than you if they were turned. Why you? What makes you so vulnerable to this sort of attempt?
Sile looked at her and then turned apologetic eyes toward Leader.
I'm Corellian.
He glanced toward his datapad.
Right. Born on Corellia, raised on Raltir.
No. Born on Corellia, raised on Corellia. The recruiting officer assumed and put down that I was raised on Raltir because I have Raltir citizenship, but I didn't get it the usual way. I bought it.
The woman said,
What else in your record is incorrect? Nothing, but Lysa Dunton. Well, that isn't the name I was born with. I changed it. Legally, at a court on Raltir that is known for being horribly disorganized. I knew it would take years for the records to reach the GA military. I changed it to avoid comparisons with my father, so I could achieve a reputation of my own.
What's your real, the woman checked herself,
your original name?
Sile Antilles. Both the woman and Leader blinked. The woman reacted first.
Corellian Antilles. You aren't by chance.
He's my father.
And Ayella Antilles, your mother?
I'm surprised you know that name. The woman nodded.
So the mechanic tries to persuade you to perform unspecified actions for the Corellian government?
Sile nodded.
And he threatened to do things to my family if I didn't comply.
Leader gave Sile a hard stare.
So you've just gotten your family killed. You refused. That agent's superiors will now begin the purge. Good going.
Sile settled back in her chair, putting a precious few more centimeters distance between herself and her squadron leader.
I hope not.
I'll tell you what, Leader said. We'll look into this. If you're lying, you get a dishonorable discharge and whatever criminal punishment you deserve. If you're telling the truth, things are much better. You get an honorable discharge and you can go home to Corellia and fly with your daddy's squadrons and give us a crack at you. Either way, this is the last day you'll wear the Galactic Alliance uniform. Dismissed.
Sile started to rise.
Sit, the woman said. She turned to Leader. You, be a good boy and go away.
Leader gaped at her.
You?
The woman smiled at him, showing teeth.
The correct response is, yes, ma'am.
Now go. Leader evaluated her expression, then hurriedly rose.
Yes, ma'am.
The woman waited until he was out of the interrogation room. She returned her attention to Sile.
Yes, we'll verify the details of your story. If they check out, you'll be returned to active service. but I doubt you'll be returned to Vibro Sword Squadron. I suspect that it can be considered a hostile environment for you now.
I think you're right.
The woman turned her attention to the datapad in front of her.
It says here that you were offered the chance to join a new squadron, handling the first deployment of the Aleph-class fighters. Is that correct?
Sile nodded.
I didn't want to, though. I've played around with the Aleph simulators. They've got plenty of speed, but they maneuver like big plugs of Duracrete.
And if your only options are to fly Alephs or work as a communications officer aboard a sensor ship?
Alephs sound great, ma'am.
Spoken like a true Antilles.
The woman closed her datapad.
Lord City, Lord.
She was willowy, tall, with long black hair and a flowing ponytail. Ben saw her first from the cockpit of Jason's shuttle as the vehicle drifted down on repulsor lifts. The woman was merely a shadowy figure leaning, arms crossed against the hangar pit wall. She walked quickly to the ramp's base, her attention fixed on Jason, her hand extended toward the adult Jedi.
Jason, she said, it's good to see you.
Jason reached the bottom of the ramp and took her hand, but did not draw her into an embrace.
Nalani, Jason said.
When I heard that you were the Jedi assigned to the Lord's station, that you'd be the one meeting us, I was glad.
Really?
Glad to realize that you'd passed your trials and were fully vested as a Jedi Knight. Congratulations. Her smile faltered slightly.
Thank you.
She released her grip on his hand, and her attention finally turned to Ben.
And this must be Ben Skywalker.
Ben stood silent. Nalani cast a worried glance at Jason.
Does he talk?
Ben's vocabulary suddenly returned.
You're being condescending,
Ben said.
Absently, she ruffled his hair.
Certainly not. You just had me puzzled for a moment.
She returned her attention to Jason.
So what did you want to do first? Get settled in your quarters at the station?
Have you researched the matter I calmed you about? Jason asked.
Ben fell into line behind them, furiously smoothing his hair.
Yes, and I found a contact who seems to know something about your tassels. A Dr. Hylan Rotham. Tactile writing and recording methods are her specialty.
Dr. Rotham's offices, also her quarters, were on the ground floor of a university building built of Duracrete bricks and false woods, then comfortably aged for a couple of centuries. The walls of the corridors and chambers were dark, either soothing or shadowy and threatening, depending on one's attitude towards such things, and so somber that it seemed to Ben that they could swallow all humor. He looked over to the table where Dr. Rotham sat with Jason and Nalani. Dr. Rotham was a human woman, tiny and ancient. She held Jason's mass of tassels up before her eyes, scrutinizing them from a distance of only 4 or 5 centimeters.
This one, Dr. Rotham said, is definitely Bith, a recording method of an isolated island race, the Alagar, that concocted the knotting style as a means of recording genealogies, strings of ancestors. Later, the technique was expanded to permit the recording of thoughts and statements. Roughly translated, it means he will ruin those who deny justice.
Nalani frowned.
That's curiously ominous.
Why? Jason asked.
Yeah, Ben said. Jedi do that all the time. Ruin those who deny justice.
Nalani shook her head.
Ruination is sometimes a result of what we do, but it's not usually the goal. Ruination as a goal sounds like vengefulness, not a trait suited to a Jedi.
Ben caught Jason's eye, silently requesting confirmation of Nalani's assertion. Jason shrugged unhelpfully.
I'm certain I can translate many of the others, Dr. Rotham continued. Though, since they all appear to be separated from their cultural contexts, how accurate those translations will be is somewhat up in the air. Perhaps they provide a context for one another. If so, that will be helpful.
Jason nodded. I'd appreciate whatever you could tell us. He turned to Nalani and Ben, indicating the door. I get the impression that Dr. Rotham would like some time alone
to complete any more translations. Ben, why don't you have a look around the spaceport while I update Nalani on the Corellian situation? Ben gave a reluctant shrug of agreement.
Coruscant.
It was like a replay of their first conference from days earlier, with Cal Omos, Admiral Pelion, and Admiral Nyathol occupying the same seats at the conference table when Luke was escorted into the chamber. They and their aides looked up as the Jedi Master entered and seated himself. Omos said,
"I believe you have some news for us."
Luke said, "As you probably saw in the report I forwarded, there's little doubt that Thrakken Sal Solo sabotaged the Toryaz Station conference, or at least through his inaction permitted it to be sabotaged." Omos's mouth turned downward.
"Unfortunately, the difference between those two behaviors is the difference between the most serious sort of crime and a non-crime."
"Non-crime?" Luke looked appalled. "You're joking."
"No."
Omos, for this moment, looked like a man impervious to humor. Certainly not a generator of amusement.
"Assuming that he did not pay for the information offered in the message he received, can you prove that he took the message seriously, that it was credible to him? Because he can always claim that he did not consider it a credible offer, that it was a communication from a crank, and therefore did not need to be acted on in any capacity."
Luke shook his head, unhappy to be thwarted by so negligible an obstacle. "Still, if a strike team were able to capture him and bring him to Coruscant, a criminal trial based on the assumption that he did buy the information could drag on for months, or longer, keeping Sal Solo out of commission during all that time. And that would be a boon to the peace process." The others exchanged glances.
"That," Nyathol said, "is a far more pragmatic suggestion than I expected from a Jedi. I like it."
Luke leaned back. "Jedi are among the most pragmatic beings in the galaxy. We tend to operate under the assumption that it's better to get things done than to observe all the niceties. We consider justice to be more of a consequence than law, for instance. Even justice is often overrated. Sometimes the imposition of justice prevents redemption." Pelion nodded.
"Were you planning to remain on Coruscant, or return to Corellia and resume control of your squadron?"
"I was planning to return to Trallis."
"We would appreciate it if you would stay here for a few days more, until we have a better sense of how the Jedi would best be posted during this crisis."
Luke nodded. "As you wish."
Lord City, Lord.
Later that day, Ben stood behind Jason's chair, looking back and forth from the real tassels resting on a table to a hologram of the tassels floating above. Dr. Rotham began her initial evaluation.
"Number one, at the top, is from Fyrir, a dead world, its population scattered. The knotting technique was originally for recording, and in some superstitious cultures, magically influencing names. Its message, he will remake himself, or perhaps rename himself, the two concepts being identical in this context. Next is the one I translated for you earlier, from the Bith species, Alagar race. He will ruin those who deny justice. The scarlet and black one was easy, as it was the second of the tactile writing systems I learned, a recording technique used by the prisoners on Kessel. He will choose the fate of the weak."
Though Jason didn't move, Ben felt a jolt of emotion from him. Nalani must have felt it too. She gave Jason a curious look, but he did not acknowledge it. Keeping his attention on Dr. Rotham, the scholar seemed to be oblivious to the exchange.
"I can't determine the meaning of the next one in the sequence. The poisonous-looking yellow and green one. After that comes a very tricky one. The red, yellow, and pale green tassel is actually a representation of a flower arrangement from the old Alderanian language of flowers. Imagine it as a bouquet in a vase, the red and yellow splotches constituting the petals, and the green the stems, and you get a sense of it. Its meaning is, he will choose how he will be loved." Actually, instead of he, it should be I, but I'm taking the liberty of assuming that the third person is to be used here, as it is everywhere else.
Speaking of which, Nalani interrupted, is it definitely he, or could it be also read as she throughout?
Dr. Rotham shook her head.
It isn't defined in all the tassels, but everywhere it is, it's distinctly he. Where was I? Oh, yes. After that, a very simple one. The gray and brown one is from a still extant Coruscanti subculture of indigenants, transients who pride themselves on being jobless, living by theft and begging. This three-dimensional representation of their language states, he will win and break his chains.
She continued.
He will shed his skin and choose a new skin. He will strengthen himself through sacrifice. He will crawl through his cloak. He will know brotherhood. He will make a pet. By which I don't mean he will tame some creature, but that he will somehow fabricate a pet.
Finally, Dr. Rotham's translations reached the end.
This one you already knew. Ryloth, Tahuip culture. He will strengthen himself through pain.
Jason nodded. That's all very helpful, Doctor. You skipped one. He stood and reached out to the hologram, his fingertips touching a tan tassel featuring jagged black lines.
Yes, I could not translate that one. Though I've seen the recording method before. The zigzag patterns, the arrays of protruding claws and teeth.
Dr. Rotham looked uncertain.
In statuary and figurines from the world of Xyost.
This time it was Nalani who looked startled. Jason accepted the information with a simple nod. It means something like, he will be drawn from peace into conflict. Or maybe his life will be balanced between peace and conflict. The scholar gave him a curious look.
How do you know?
Believe it or not, I just feel it. The tassel's meaning is imbued within it in a fashion that only a force wielder can read.
I can't read it,
Nalani said. Jason shrugged. Maybe when you've broadened your range of force-related learning a bit.
What's Xyost?
Ben asked.
One of the worlds central to the origins of the Sith,
Nalani said. There's actually a substantial Sith influence to this collection of statements. Jason gestured at the hologram. Several of them seem to be paraphrases of portions of the Sith creed. The one about victory and chains, for instance. What we have here is an item fabricated by someone who is at least as familiar with Sith matters as a Jedi historian would be.
I hope it's only a historian,
Dr. Rotham said.
One last thing I can tell you is this. I brought in a bead crafter to look at these items, and he's certain that they were crafted by different hands. So you're not dealing with a single individual who's an expert in all these recording techniques. You're dealing with someone who has collected them, arranged for their assembly, rather than someone who has fabricated them all. Which is a considerable relief to me, because the alternative would be that I have an academic rival I've been unaware of all these decades.
She drew a hand over her brow, miming a gesture of relief. Jason gave her a smile. Doctor, your help has been invaluable, and we've asked you to do far too much work in far too short an amount of time. I do appreciate it. She beamed up at him.
I consider it my chance, so late in life, to offer some thanks to the Jedi for all they've done.
We'll leave you now, but if anything does occur to you about any of the tassels, any of the translations, don't hesitate to get a message to us. Jason wrapped the collection of tassels in a cloth and returned it to his belt pouch.
Good luck with your investigation, Jedi Solo.
Once the Jedi were in the corridor outside Dr. Rotham's quarters and headed toward Nalani's speeder, Jason asked, "So how was the rest of your day, Ben?"
"Oh, pretty good, I guess."
Ben struggled to look and feel nonchalant. I found the shuttle. Jason smiled. Well, that couldn't have been too difficult. You were at the spaceport.
Not your shuttle.
Jason frowned. Whose?
The shuttle that escaped Toryaz Station.
Jason almost stumbled, and Ben suppressed the urge to laugh. Jason said,
Wait, are you sure?
Ben nodded.
The transponder code is a match, and so is the design. It's a Sentinel-class lander, with the weapon system stripped out.
How did you find it?
Nalani asked. Ben grimaced. This was going to be difficult to explain, to put into words. On the other hand, Nalani was a Jedi.
I kept noticing when shuttles landed, they kind of drew my attention, even when transports and cargo ships didn't, which seemed weird at the time.
Nalani nodded.
The Force was guiding you. You were open to it.
I guess. And then I remembered something my mother says a lot. She says that any detail, no matter how small, could turn out to be important. And I remembered about the shuttle from Toryaz Station. Mom's a spy, you know.
Nalani grinned.
I know. So I went through my datapad, all Jason's notes on details we haven't had time to go through, and I decided to see if the spaceport record showed anything about that shuttle. And there it was, parked half a kilometer from our shuttle.
Who's it registered to? Jason asked. Ben pulled out his datapad and opened it. He left all that information on the screen.
A human woman named Brisha Sayo. She's from Kaminor. She wasn't at the shuttle. She just paid for a week's worth of hangar space. She left no contact information. The spaceport authority thought she was staying aboard, but the ship's systems were all shut down. I told the guy who's in charge of security for the spaceport, Lieutenant Samran. He's got somebody watching it now.
Very good, Jason said. But what if this Brisha Sayo sneaks aboard and takes off when Samran's guard is snoozing?
Then the transmitter we stuck on top of the hull will tell us where she goes.
A comlink beeped. Jason and Nalani sighed and reached for their respective communication devices. But it was Ben's that had sounded. He pulled it out of his pouch.
Ben Skywalker here.
Really?
Did she put up a fight? All right. We'll be there in half an hour or so.
He sought Jason's face for confirmation, got a nod, and concluded.
Out. That was Lieutenant Samran. Brisha Sayo showed up.
The shuttle pilot?
Yeah, she's in custody.
Let's go.
Jason led the dash for the speeder. The human woman sitting alone in the security interrogation room did not look like a criminal, at least on the surface. Clad in a purple jumpsuit that suggested both money and a preference for simplicity, she was about the same age as Ben's parents, at the height of vigorous middle age. She was lean, with well-defined muscles suggesting an active life, and had dark hair, slightly curled, cut short in an easy-to-maintain hairdo. Her features were fine, and she was attractive. Her beauty was very approachable. She looked like the sort of woman who had been a greeter in a shop or hotel in her youth, and still carried the mannerisms of that profession. The chamber she waited in featured a one-way reflective panel that showed her a mirrored surface, while the Jedi on the other side could look through it like a viewport. Ben had the unsettling feeling that she was restraining herself from looking at the Jedi, that at any moment she would look up and lock eyes with one of them, despite the physical impossibility of her seeing them. Ben knew better than to assume that her good looks and apparent friendliness meant she was a good person. His upbringing had grounded him in principles of both logic and the Force, and both disciplines knew that an attractive appearance could conceal malevolence. Still, he detected none in her. A Lord security guard led them into the interrogation chamber. Jason waited until the guard had exited, then sat and gestured for Nalani and Ben to do likewise. They took the chairs on the opposite side of the table from the woman.
Hello, she said, her voice warm. Jedi Solo, Jedi Din, young Skywalker.
You know us, Jason said.
Of course. I've been meddling in your business for some time.
You admit it?
I admit to that, yes.
What was your involvement with the events at Toryaz Station? Jason asked.
I was there to observe you. I used my arts to stay out of the sight of the Jedi and the station's security forces, and I spied on you.
Then, when everything went wrong, I decided that I needed to get out of the way until that mess was settled for the time being. I left something to lead you to me.
The tassels.
Yes, of course.
You were pretty confident that they would lead me to you. She nodded.
I knew one would speak to you and you alone. And from my own researches, I already knew that this collection of tassels would inevitably point to Dr. Rotham on Lord for decipherment. Any other so-called experts in the field would eventually refer you to her. So you'd be here sooner or later.
You killed the security captain, Towler. She shook her head.
I saw him killed from a distance. A hooded figure spaced him through an airlock. Knowing that the Jedi investigations would lead to that airlock, I chose to leave the tassels there. Then I walked out of the Narsak habitat before security measures closed off the corridor to the main station.
And you coincidentally ended up in the same shuttle by which the soldiers arrived at the station?
No coincidence. I used my own resources to track it down. Not tricky at all, since I assumed it would go to the Corellia system. And there it was, hangared at the main Coronet City spaceport. I confronted its pilot, but he attacked me rather than answer questions, and I was forced to kill him, which left me in possession of the shuttle.
And then you came here, because you knew that the tassels would lead the Jedi who found them here to Lord. She shook her head.
Not the Jedi who found them. You.
You almost ended up with my sister running down their origin.
I don't think so. In all the galaxy, only you, Jason Solo, would be sufficiently intrigued to follow them all the way here and beyond.
Why me?
Because only you could read and understand one of the tassels. Only you could detect its significance.
And so you'd demand to be the one who investigated it. All right, Jason said. Let's put all this into some sort of context. Let's have your story from the start.
No, not here. I'll tell you at my home.
On Kaminor?
No, my true home. On a planetoid in a star system close to Bamiel. Not far from here, as galactic distances go. We could take your shuttle, or mine.
No thanks.
Then you're not getting any more answers.
Jason stood. Let's talk outside, he told Nalani and Ben, and left. They followed. Once in the corridor, he said, I'm going to visit her home. Nalani shook her head, not taking her eyes from Jason's.
Why?
I have to know how she spoke to me through the tassel, he said. Does she know something about me I don't know myself? Or is it a method she could use on other Jedi, perhaps to lure them into traps? I can't just ignore this or assume that imprisoning her would eliminate the risk she may represent.
But it's a trap,
Ben protested. Jason gave him a dismissive look.
A trap to do what?
Well, kill you, I guess.
Why lure me out to some planetoid?
I don't know, and neither do you. Just because you can't figure out what she's up to doesn't mean it isn't bad.
Ben's right, Nalani said. The woman's story is too weird and complicated. Going to where she's the master of the environment is just a bad idea.
Nevertheless, I'm doing just that. Nalani frowned.
Then I'm going with you.
Jason shook his head. That's outside your jurisdiction.
I don't have a jurisdiction. I'm just assigned to live on Lord. It's fine for me to investigate something as near as Bamiel, especially when it involves the safety of another Jedi, and a mystery that involves the Sith world of Zyost. Do you think Master Skywalker would object to my going? I suspect he'd insist on it.
All right, Jason shrugged. I just think it's a bad idea for you to go.
Corellian system above Tralis.
Leia, led to the bridge of Dodona, marveled as she always did at the extravagant open spaces of a Star Destroyer-style command area. Admiral Tarla Limpan, flanked by the ubiquitous aides and advisors any top-ranking naval officer warranted, stepped forward energetically as Leia moved onto the bridge walkway. A female of the Duro species, she had pale gray-green skin and facial features that looked like a cartoonish simplification of a human's. Large red eyes without visible iris or pupil, an almost featureless mouth,
and a broad, empty space where a nose should have been between them. She smiled and extended her long arms to seize Leia's hand between her own, shaking it enthusiastically.
"Madame Organa Solo," she said. "How should I address you? Princess? Senator? Head of state?"
Leia smiled, disarmed by the Admiral's informal manner and energy.
"Call me Leia." "I am Tarla. I was informed you were in the Corellian system, keeping lines of communication open with the new Prime Minister, and a good thing it is."
She belatedly released Leia's hand.
"To what do I owe the pleasure of this meeting? And I must add a certain sadness at seeing you arrive alone, by shuttle. Someday you might grace me by introducing me to your husband and his famous transport."
"Of course. But Han at the moment is out visiting old smuggler haunts, trying to get a sense of black market traffic and what it means to the current crisis." That was a blatant lie, but one that anyone from either side would find difficult to disprove. "I'm here just to visit, in whatever minutes would be at your convenience. And perhaps to get a tour of your vessel. I haven't seen one of the new battle carriers up close." It was another lie. She was here in the hope that by being in the right place at the right time, she might, however slightly, be able to improve the chances that her husband would survive the next few hours.
"I shall be glad to oblige. Allow me to introduce you to my aide. I will volunteer him for the tour, and then you and I can chat."
Coronet Corellia.
"Circuit trace routes?"
The female voice sounded equally strong in both of Han's ears, and was pure, true of tone. Han shook his head. It must be nice to own a vehicle where every component was brand new and flawless, like the YT-5100 Shriek-class bomber whose cockpit he occupied. On the other hand, something that new and shining lacked spirit. Millennium Falcon had spirit in abundance, memories ground into every surface. By comparison, this Shriek was a machine.
"Circuit trace routes?"
the voice said again. Its persistence jolted Han out of his reverie. He scanned the control boards ahead of him.
99.732, he said.
"Atmospheric pressure?"
"Corellia sea level standard 1.0003, and zero variance from the pressure reading when we started the checklist."
"Complete. You are ready to launch. Re-enabling comm lines to Panther 1.
There was the faintest of clicks, and then Han heard Wedge's voice.
"Ready to launch?"
"Ready."
In truth, Han didn't feel entirely ready. He was at last beginning to question his role in this operation. Leia had questioned it days ago, become resigned to it, and supported Han in his decision ever since. Now her doubts had finally wandered into his brain. Was it the best idea for him to join this mission, having to train for it in secrecy? On the other hand, when had he ever decided against something just because it was a bad idea? Not in 40 years or so, and seldom before then. Doing things even though they were bad ideas had gotten him a decades-long friendship with a noble Wookiee, had landed him a wife no other woman in the galaxy could compare to, had gotten him beat up a lot.
"Launch!"
Han kicked the thrusters and put the Shriek into as steep an ascent as possible, going to a true vertical climb within 2 seconds. Through his forward viewport, the blue skies of Corellia gave way with a startlingly brief time to black space decorated with untwinkling stars.
"Star system MZX-32905 near Bemeel."
On the view screen at maximum magnification, Brish's home was a hemispherical light gray bump, a blemish on an irregular dark gray surface. When Jason stepped the view screen down to a medium magnification, he could see the entirety of the asteroid as a dark shadow in the midst of a sea of stars. And beyond it, the tiny, dirty orange glow of this star system's sun, not far from the Bemeel system, whose fifth planet was notorious for its slash rat population, and for being the site of an early Yuuzhan Vong surveying expedition. Nalani, hovering over Jason's shoulder, stared at Brish's asteroid and said,
"Lovely."
Brish's face was reflected in the transperisteel of the forward viewport, and Jason saw her offer Nalani a smile that was just one step short of condescending.
"It's private," she said. "I like privacy."
Jason ignored them, and ignored the sensor readouts before him. Instead, he concentrated on sensing the Force. On that planetoid, there was something active within the Force, something strong and vibrant, but not alive.
It's a big iron asteroid, Ben announced.
The docking bay was large enough to hold four shuttles, or the Millennium Falcon and one or two smaller craft. As Jason's shuttle settled into place into the berth nearest the doors into the habitat proper, the big bay doors slid into place laterally behind them. Jason felt himself settle deeper into his seat as the habitat's artificial gravity dialed up. He saw Brisha smile at him in the viewport reflection.
All the answers you're looking for are inside, she said.
Jason nodded, which is not the same as saying everything we want is inside, or that we're safe inside.
Correct, Brisha said.
She rose. A flexible airlock corridor attached itself to their exterior hatch. Inside, the air was cold, but little eddies of warmth moved through it, evidence of the habitat's heaters beginning their business. The hallway, off-white and featureless on the inside, led them to a cross corridor in the same sky blue as the bay interior. Ben looked around, blinking.
It's really clean. I thought this was a mining station.
Brisha shook her head.
No, it was the administration habitat for the mining company. This place was more like a hotel than a mining camp.
In terms of design, it's like an early model Sinar mobile command post, Jason said.
But older. Maybe centuries older. At Brisha's slight nod, he continued.
It would have been assembled in space, near where it was to be set up originally. Tugs would have placed it on foundation columns built at its landing zone, but it was a valuable piece of equipment. When the operation was done, its foundation clamps would have released, and it would have been towed off to its next station, not left here.
Brisha gave him an encouraging smile, then turned and led the way along the corridor.
Very true. No, the last administrator here arranged for the habitat to be left behind when the mining operation left this asteroid field. To be left behind and forgotten.
Jason quickened his pace to catch up to Brisha. That's a lot of arranging.
Yes, it is.
Brisha looked agreeable.
But the administrator who arranged it was capable of coming up with the bribes and persuading people to look away. He was, after all, a Sith.
Brisha brushed off further questions until they reached a turbolift near the habitat's center and ridden it up four floors. It opened onto a circular chamber 20 meters across. The chamber itself could have been an extension of Dr. Rotham's quarters. Its walls were lined with shelving, and there were narrow catwalks along the shelving at 3-meter height intervals, with black metal staircases providing access between the catwalks. The shelves were thick with books, rolls of flimsy, flickering holograms, statuettes, kinetic art, and even, Jason saw, the bottled head of a Rodian. Its funnel-like snout pointed straight at the turbolift doors through which they'd entered. There was furniture at floor level, mostly long, dark sofas. The room fairly reeked of Force energy, dark side energy. But as strong as it was, this was not the source of all the power. All the dark influence Jason had been detecting since their arrival. That lay below them, a long way down. As Jason stood in the turbolift doorway, taking in the sensations of Force power like a hungry man sampling scents in a restaurant, Nalani moved into the room's center, her hand on the hilt of the lightsaber at her belt.
So you are some sort of Sith?
Brisha shook her head and moved to stretch out on the nearest sofa, her back supported by one end. The sofa puffed up a little under her weight. She leaned back, her posture negligent, and stretched her arms above her head.
No, I'm a student. A student of the Force in all its aspects. And yes, I've concentrated on knowledge of the Sith. On utilizing their techniques without greed, without self-interest, to make things better the same way the best Jedi use the light side techniques. Then you've been corrupted,
Nalani said. Brisha sighed, exasperated, and crossed her arms before her.
What is corruption? A hard-line lightsider will say that any use of the Force for personal gain is corrupt.
but someone who mixes altruism with self-interest in very human measures across a span of decades isn't corrupt. He or she is just behaving according to the nature of the species.
Jason moved over to stand before her.
Explain that. I'd love to, but first some context. This planetoid, Brisha said, was populated long before the miners came. A species of creature settled here. Desiccated bodies I've found in the deep places, and signs I've seen through the Force, indicate that they were akin to Minox, silicon-based, invertebrate, subsisting on stellar radiation and silicate materials. The ones here evolved or mutated into a sapient species, over how many millennia I can't speculate, and developed a society involving cultural hierarchies, stratification as we see in human cultures.
Jason nodded. And the remnant Force energies I'm feeling originated with them.
Yes. Their records, for they invented a form of record-keeping, a sort of information-imbued sculpture, some forms of which I've learned to translate.
One of the tassels? Jason asked.
Yes, one your expert probably couldn't read. These creatures' records indicate that at one point, a ruling class exiled a whole sub-society, sealing them within caves and caverns of this asteroid, cutting them off from the stellar energies that sustained them. They lived there, slowly dying of starvation, sustaining themselves poorly off the mineral content of the stones within the asteroid. And it was there that one of their number learned to detect and then manipulate the Force. That one eventually became leader of all the other exiles, then led them to break out of the asteroid interior and conquer the others. So why aren't all Minox now Force-wielding star travelers ruling the galaxy?
Nalani asked. Brisha shrugged.
I can only guess. In their writing, there's a reference for the home, this asteroid, plus mentions of the return, suggesting they could not spawn or divide, as the Minox do anywhere but here. If that's true, then they couldn't spread too far through the galaxy, and a fatal contagion or similar disaster here could wipe out the entire species within a matter of years. So they died out, and centuries or millennia later, an operation settled here to mine this asteroid belt.
I can guess some of the rest, Jason said. Prolonged exposure of the miners to a well of dark side energy led to weird incidents. People seeing things, force sensitives manifesting odd abilities, perhaps channeling your Minox, behaving like them, and being considered insane.
Very good,
Brisha nodded.
The director of that time hushed up the reports, closed down that mine. The rest of the operation in these asteroids was unaffected, and kept things tightly under wraps. He too was a force sensitive, and had been experiencing things, experimenting, acquiring and testing new powers. When this asteroid belt eventually became less profitable as a mining operation, he closed it down. Carefully mismanaged things so that the habitat would be left here and forgotten. And then, leaving it behind, he went out into the galaxy, finding the Sith, apprenticing himself, eventually becoming the Sith Master, Darth Vectivus.
Never heard of him, Jason said. Brisha's expression showed a little impatience.
That's because he did no evil. He didn't attempt to conquer the galaxy, try to wipe out the population of a star system, or start an all-out war with the Jedi. He just existed, learned, died of old age, surrounded by family and friends.
How did he keep from being ruled and ruined by greed? Jason asked.
Ah, that's easy. He developed a strong ethical code before he ever felt any pull from the dark side. The Sith who were famous for being bad, Jason, were the way they were because they were badly damaged men or women to start with, not because they were Sith. Usually they were weak or deluded or greedy to begin with, like your grandfather. I knew him, you know.
Jason shook his head. How could I know? I don't know anything about you.
Conceited, I haven't been using my true name. It's inconvenient.
So you're saying that you didn't lure us here to kill us?
Correct.
And it wasn't because you're lonely or just wanted to show the place off? Brisha's smile turned genuine again,
No. Then why?
Because down in the caverns, where the dark side power is greatest, there is a Sith Lord, and I didn't think I should face him alone.
Corellian space above Tralos.
Leia sat in the officer's mess with Admiral Impan, steaming cups of caff on the gleaming white table between them.
The GA tends to fall into the old trap of thinking of the Corellians as naughty children, Leia said. They're not. They're people who have never lost the pioneering spirit, even though their system has been well settled for millennia. Pioneering spirit, pioneering contempt for authority, pioneering disdain for complication or overanalysis. Think of them as children, and you inevitably forget how dangerous they...
A shrill alarm cut off her words. Uniformed officers at the surrounding table stood, as did Limpan and Leia.
Intrusion alert, the Admiral said. I'm needed. I'll stay with you if I may, Leia said.
The bridge was only a few dozen meters away, and when Limpan and Leia charged through the blast doors onto the elevated walkway, it was buzzing with activity. Officers shouted reports to one another, and a hologram of nearby space hung above the walkway. It showed the curved orbital line of distantly spaced Galactic Alliance ships and a formation of incoming craft in three groups. The fuzziness and blob-like nature of the formation informing Leia that its exact composition had not yet been determined by the sensors.
All vessels and ground control, go to battle stations. Launch all ready squadrons, Limpan shouted. Navigation, what's their course?
A male officer, also a Duros in one of the pits below, called up.
60-40 probability, Relidir or Blue Diver.
Starfighter control, route 1 squadron and 4 down toward Relidir, 2 and 4 toward Blue Diver. 1 and 4 remains with each launching ship.
The Admiral's head whipped around as she studied each station below the walkway.
Admiral, Leia said, I have some expertise with starfighter coordination, if I can be of any help.
Limpan nodded absently.
Back through the blast doors we came in, immediate right, that is, to the ship's port, first door. Tell Colonel Moyan to confirm your involvement with my aid, and thanks.
Sile cursed as her Twi cleared the exit doors of Blue Diver Hangar and slowly began to accelerate. Gray One turned to lead the rest of the squadron down into the atmosphere. Sile checked her navigation board, saw that their destination was a point due south of the city of Relidir. She nodded. The Corellians were coming to take their city back. She didn't know whether in her heart to wish them luck or not. Panther Flight, Han and Wedge, stayed well toward the rear of the Corellian formation. Han chafed. It was wrong to be at the rear of any formation. To make things more irritating, Han still hadn't heard from Leia. Admittedly, communication between them was going to be tricky and occasional. He glanced at the comm-equipped datapad that he had carefully glued to the Shriek control board once he'd been sealed into the vehicle. Its lit screen remained aggravatingly blank. Worse still, Wedge seemed to be reading his mind.
Don't get impatient, he said,
his voice so clear in Han's ears that he could have been sitting in the now-empty co-pilot seat.
We'll get there soon enough.
Impatient?
Han added an edge of disbelief to his voice.
Sonny, I'm just sitting here playing Sabacc with the droid brains.